The Day in News happens here.
We have a teacher shortage in Ontario.
Every day, as events unfold, we're here for you.
And they are projecting increases in spending.
This is The Daily Review on Newstalk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from The Morning Rush with Bill Carroll.
Saw this one in the Globe and Mail. I had to know more about it. It's a tax court case that happened last year, and it involves a Montreal tenant and Canada Revenue. And it, if you look at the headlines, it's kind of bizarre that essentially what we're dealing with here, I think, is that a foreign landlord didn't pay his taxes, so his tenant now has to pay the tax on the landlord's behalf. Am I getting that right? Let's find out. Valentin Erickson of Erickson Law Firm was involved in that, and he's on the line right now. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So, maybe walk me through this from the beginning, because it's hard to imagine that a tenant is on the hook for a tax that a landlord had to pay. What's this part about the tenant failed to withhold on the monthly rent a non-resident sum? What is that?
This has something to do with Part 13 of the Income Tax Act, but let me just summarize the facts of this case. They're very straightforward. It involved a numbered corp and Mr. David Sisko. He was a shareholder of the corp. Mr. Sisko leased his personal residence from Anjar Investments back in May 1996, and then unbeknownst to Mr. Sisko, the property was sold by Anjar Investments to Sebastiana Trimarchi. And Mrs. Trimarchi was a resident of Italy at that time. So what happened, entered in a three-year lease for the same property with Mrs. Trimarchi. He didn't know that she was not a resident of Canada. She never remitted any taxes to the CRA, and then CRA basically knocked at his door and say, hey, you're in the hook for paying property taxes. Part 13 of the Income Tax Act, it imposes a tax on certain types of income paid to non-residents by Canadian residents. So, for example, the tax specifically requires a 25% withholding tax on gross rent paid for the use of property in Canada owned by a non-resident individual. And the responsibility for withholding and remitting the appropriate amounts under Part 13 falls on the Canadian resident taxpayer. And if a tenant fails to withhold and remit the required tax, as what happened in this case, then the Canadian tenant is liable for the tax under Part 13, along with any associated penalties and interest. And this is what happened to Mr. Sisko.
I got to tell you, Valentin, I've never heard of that, that a tenant was responsible for withholding tax amounts. Does that tenant then file the money directly with Canada Revenue? How's that supposed to work?
So basically, the Canada Revenue Agency said, hey, you know what, this is right in the Income Tax Act. Maybe you didn't know about this, but, you know, it's not our problem. You have to collect and remit taxes to the CRA. And the Tax Court of Canada Justice Gabrielle Saint-Hilaire, she adhered to the strict interpretation of the law. She looked at the section of the Income Tax Act, and she said there is nothing in the Income Tax Act stating that even if you didn't know about it, it's still on you to collect taxes on behalf of the non-resident.
But who are you collecting it from? Aren't you collecting it from yourself, the tenant?
You have to withhold it. So, for example, your rent is like, I don't know, $2,000. You're supposed to withhold 25%, open an account, and then remit it to the Canada Revenue Agency.
Really? That's just astounding. So in this case, Mr. Sisko, the tenant, was paying the entire, let's say it's $2,000, the entire amount to the owner of the property through that company.
That's right. He was paying to the owner of the property. He didn't know that she was not resident here in Canada. And CRA said, you know what, she never remitted, she never paid taxes, so you're in the hook for that. Now, like, I know the Justice Santander also stated in the decision that Section 216 of the Income Tax Act authorizes a non-resident to elect to pay Part 1 tax on net rental income from real property in Canada rather than the 25% flat tax on gross rental payments. And then, of course, he would Also, if you do it through a property manager, I have to notice if you do it through a property manager, then you don't have to collect tax because the property manager is going to take care of you. But basically, yes, the rule is very straightforward, and you could be on the hook if you don't do your due diligence and if you don't collect tax.
So if you're renting directly from someone who is non-resident Canada, foreign owner, and they say the rent is $2,000 a month, then you should deduct the amount of tax from that, give them the difference, and keep the rest for Revenue Canada.
That's right. You should withhold 25%, apparently open an account, and remit this money to the Canada Revenue Agency. Yes. That's why it's very important for everybody who is renting to conduct due diligence. You know, tenants should not rely on statements provided by landlords regarding residency status. Instead, they should conduct their own inquiries and verify the landlord's tenancy status. You know, a lot of lawyers also say, you know, you should include protective covenants and representations in your lease. For example, lease agreements should contain provisions specifically addressing Part 13 tax obligations, including, you know, treatment of withholding taxes, landlord residency status, and notification requirements. Like I understand from media reports that the federal government will propose a renter's bill of rights. You know, like these measures would include a national standard lease agreement, and maybe this is something our members of parliament could consider when this legislation goes to the committee.
Maybe. I mean, it absolutely should, because I can't imagine many people know about this. The only hopeful thing maybe, Valentin, is that maybe this circumstance doesn't pop up all that often.
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm pretty sure it doesn't happen often, and I also practice real estate law. So, for example, when people sell property in Canada, they always have to sign a statutory declaration stating that they are residents of Canada. And basically, if they're not, then the lawyers would hold back 25% of the sale price and then remit it to the CRA. So maybe something like this could also happen with the tenants. But I do believe that tenants have to be protected 100% because the way the law stands right now, basically the CRA could go after the tenants if non-residents don't collect and remit taxes to the CRA.
So what would you advise to someone who hears this and says, I got to find out what's going on, and you realize that, yes, your landlord isn't a resident of Canada and you have not been putting aside that tax for the government? What would you recommend they do? Should they immediately withhold that portion?
I would say they have to have that conversation and say, yes, we have to comply with the legislation. We have to hold back 25% if you're a non-resident, and then we have to remit it to the CRA. Of course, if they're dealing with a property manager, then my understanding is that it's the property manager's responsibility to do that.
So if you end up owing the CRA over this, I would expect then if you're going to hire someone like you, you're going to hire a lawyer to go after the landlord and try to get the money back you paid, because you paid the full rent. And it's not your fault that portion, well, the court ruled it was your fault, but you paid the full rent, including the tax. So technically, isn't the landlord on the hook to give the tenant the money back?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The landlord is also on the hook, and I'm pretty sure the CRA would also go after the landlord. Like, the only problem is that the landlord, in this case, the landlord who is in Italy, we don't know if the landlord is ever going to come here. And so it's easier for the CRA to go after the Canadian resident than a person who is a non-resident, right?
Yeah, you could sue them, but good luck collecting.
Exactly, exactly. And then another takeaway from this would be, you're right, like just maybe seek some kind of indemnity clause in the contract, you know, like depending on their negotiating power, tenants may seek indemnity from landlords for any liabilities arising after Part 13 taxes, penalties, and interest. But you're right, they absolutely have the right to go after the landlord and collect the tax.
This is a pretty crazy story. Thank you for explaining it to us. We appreciate it.
No problem, sir. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Thank you. One more thing to worry about if you're a tenant. Valentin Erickson Law Firm, about a foreign landlord failed to pay taxes, and the CRA says, yeah, the tenant is on the hook. That, in Canada, is the law.
We'll return with more of the big stories trending now on The Daily Review.
On News Talk 580 CFRA. Live, local, breaking news, weather and traffic. The day in news happens here. Now back to The Daily Review on News Talk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from Ottawa at Work with Patricia Bull.
Middle of April. It was about a month ago, right? March 21st, the date for the vacant unit tax declaration that we all had to do in the city. We've had to do the last couple of years. Let the city know that, yes, in fact, I do reside in my home. I know because my parents were calling me about it for a couple of weeks in March saying, are you coming over to do that? Because I'll help them out occasionally with stuff like that. And it's easy to do online, right? So that's how most people do it. And online is not always the most fun for some of the seniors out there. Doesn't take very long, but you have to make the effort to actually do it by the deadline to avoid being penalized. Well, my next guest says his parents-in-law were just a slight bit late, and now they're getting hit by a fine, and he's a little frustrated with that. Bob Paquette is a son-in-law to the seniors I'm referring to. Good morning to you, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
I am very well, thank you. So tell me about this situation. What happened in your particular case?
Well, in this case here, the in-laws were very sort of preoccupied with all kinds of situations this past winter, health-wise and stuff. They're mid-80s, you know, their health is not that great. So in any event, my father-in-law did take the initiative and did do the, the report or the, the acknowledgement that they do reside in their condominium. Now, he did it on the phone. They're not tech-savvy people, so they did it over the phone. And at that point, there was no indication that there was any issues of any sort. So the person at the other end just took the information and everything seemed to be good. Now, fast forward a few weeks later, they received a document stating that they're fined $250 for a late completion of the document. Now, you know, $250, you know, for some people is, you know, it's not a huge deal, but quite frankly, they're on a fixed income, elderly. It's a couple of weeks' groceries for these people. They don't take advantage of any social services. Thankfully, they don't need to. But where I'm extremely frustrated is that I've been trying to reach the city for over 2.5 weeks to no avail to speak into anyone of any authority. It's, you know, clerks, and they only have a certain amount of, leverage or ability to do anything. And on three occasions, I was assured I was going to be getting a call back by someone in a position of authority to discuss the situation. Now, it's never happened. They never call me back. I've actually reached out, and I'm quite disappointed in Matt Luloff. He's the alderman for our area. I reached out to him on two occasions. No callback there.
The city councillor, Matt Luloff.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, you're sort of sitting in limbo.
I mean, I'm with you that I feel like it's one more thing when you do have older parents that you're trying to help out with. One more thing online, and sometimes it's easier to make the phone call. And if you think that, you know, your father-in-law thought that he had done that and made the phone call and gone through the process, you would think that when you explain that to them, they'd say, okay, well, just make sure you've definitely got it done in time next year. And
correct.
They're living in the house. They are okay. I mean, this is the vacant unit tax is aimed at discouraging people from leaving properties that are run down and other issues,
correct.
Right? So yeah. There's no issue. They're actually living there and it's just slightly late. It seems like a pretty easy fine, in my opinion, to be waived.
It was actually one day. It was one day late.
One day late.
Is what my father-in-law told me. I wasn't physically with him when he made the call.
Yeah.
But he's very clear-headed. I have no reason to doubt what he told me.
Okay.
He's told me. So one day late. And the infuriating part is that I'm not even able to discuss it with someone like you just mentioned. You know, if I could discuss it, you know, who knows? Maybe they would sort of use a bit of common sense and realize, okay, you know what? This one's frivolous and we'll let it go.
All right.
But they're not even getting back to us.
All right, Bob, we'll follow up on this, but interesting. Thank you for sharing your situation. I understand where you're coming from. Appreciate you talking to us this morning.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Bob Paquette, again, son-in-law to seniors who are now being fined. Now, immediately I have someone texting saying, Patricia, why are you even talking about this on the radio? They missed the deadline. Pay the fine. Quit the complaining. I mean, a lot of people were complaining when this vacant unit tax was brought in the first place, right? Why do we have to let the city know that, yes, we live in our house, so don't tax us. Shouldn't they have another way to be able to look at which properties are vacant? Why is the onus on the owner? But it is, and those are the rules, and that was the deadline, March 21st. So do you just follow the rules as set out with no kind of leniency or maybe a little common sense if after the fact they say, you know, I'm sorry we did not get this in on time. There was a bit of an issue. Seniors, some other stuff was going on. Apology. Okay, that's fine. We waive the $250 fee. Seems like you could do that in this case. Would love your take on this. Does anyone else have an issue with that, making this happen for seniors in your family or getting fined because you did not do it in time? Did you find a way around it at all? 580-580. Would love to hear from you on that.
We'll return with more of the big stories trending now on The Daily Review.
On News Talk 580 CFRA. Live, local, breaking news, weather and traffic. The day in news happens here. Now back to The Daily Review on News Talk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from the Vashi Capello Show.
We are continuing our new series. It's called Digging Deeper. We're taking issues that I know matter to a lot of Canadians and trying to explore them at a deeper level than we're able to on a daily basis. And the issue that we have decided to tackle first is the toxic drug overdose crisis in this country. A new study this week showed us that between 2019 and 2021, one in four young people between the ages of 20 and 39 who died from an accidental drug overdose. It is most certainly a crisis. Tens of thousands of Canadians have lost their lives to this crisis. And one of those individuals is Mike. Mike's mom is Tracy Letts. She's the vice chair of Mums Stop the Harm. She lost her son to a toxic overdose at the age of 31, and she is with us to share their story. Hi, Tracy. Good to have you on the program. Thank you for making the time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a bit about your son?
Yeah, that's always a difficult question. But my son, he was always kind of a shy and cautious child. And that didn't really change as he got older. And he was always very loving and cuddly and just wanted to snuggle and be close to people. But I think with his caution and his shyness, he really struggled with self-esteem and confidence as he grew older. And that followed him into adulthood. And, yeah, it kind of helped shape who he was and his personality and how he had to adapt to the environment that he was in. He played sports as a kid, played hockey and baseball, really seemed to enjoy the aspect of, you know, we loved playing hockey, did that all the way up until he graduated. He was an avid reader, read absolutely everything he could get his hands on. And he loved to cook and experiment and try new recipes. And he was a little bit of everything, you know. It's really hard to articulate who they are, who they were, and it evokes so many different memories and little incidents that happen that kind of help shape their personalities.
For sure. I can only imagine. I think every parent actually can definitely imagine. How did he basically, what led him to his addiction?
That's the $100 question, isn't it? Yeah. What I think, you know, what I believe about addiction is that we all could be subjected to, you know, having an addiction of one sort or another, but it depends on what happens at a particular moment in your life when you actually use a substance or something for the first time. And I think with Mike, he, like I said, he struggled with self-esteem, struggled with confidence. He did have incidents of bullying throughout school. And I think with him, he had the opportunity to try something, and he did, and it actually made him, in his world, feel a little bit more normal, feel like he was able to fit into a peer group, fit into the high school type atmosphere. And I think that's what kind of, you know, propelled him forward, is when he finally felt confident enough to be able to to move forward. And it was the using of drugs or substances that did that for him.
And what was it like as his mom to watch that unfold?
Well, you know, you always know as a parent there's something going on, but you never kind of can put your finger on it. You don't, you're waiting for that shoe to drop. You almost need to have that clarification. You need to see it to really accept it and to know what it is. And it wasn't until Mike was out of school and he had taken a job up in the oil fields. And when he would come back, because they were on like 6 weeks on, week off type thing. And so he would come back. I mean, we're starting to definitely notice changes in him every time. But it wasn't until he was back for good at Christmas one year that an ex-girlfriend of him had reached out to us and really, you know, explained to us, you know, where he was at, how problematic his drug use had become. And it was at that point that we kind of galvanized as a family and just like, oh, we need to do something. We really need to intervene, I guess is the word. It's not a great word. And it kind of threw us all into chaos. Because, you know, we didn't know what to do. There's no handbook for this.
It sounds like it's just very overwhelming. It's incredibly difficult to navigate once you realize something needs, you know, more intervention, I guess, as you said, not the greatest word, but, you know, more help needs to be addressed at a higher level. It sounds like it's really hard to figure out how to go about doing that.
Well, it really is. And, you know, having that help, because when you, as a family, when you're thrown into that situation, the amount of emotion and everything that you have to deal with is so difficult. And as a parent, as a mother, I mean, when you have a child, the first thing you do is you look at that baby and you're holding them in your arms. And you promise to look after them.
Yeah.
But you make these promises and you see, you really just have no control over certain situations, and that you, as much as you want to help and fix, that's a big word for parenting, we need to fix these things, is you recognize that you have no control and that you need to approach things differently, but it's a real convoluted journey to get there. It's a learning curve when you start on this pathway with a family member, somebody that you love, that uses substances, and you learn as you go. And for me, and as a family, we recognize that we didn't know anything and that we had to educate ourselves.
And if you had, like, I imagine there's going to be a lot of parents, given the degree to which this crisis has, you know, amplified in the last number of years, a lot of parents listening who are at that same initial stage you and your family were once at. If you had like one, and I know there's probably a lot of advice you could give them, but if, you know, one key piece of advice that you could lend them for that point in time with the benefit of hindsight, what would you tell them?
Education. Look for within every community, there are some available resources, especially within certain health authorities, et cetera. There's a lot of groups out there that can help provide resources and education, and really check yourself, check your own inherent bias before you move forward. That's the number one thing for me, is the more you know, the better equipped you are.
And when you talk also about sort of a lack of political will, I'm wondering, when you look at the scale of the crisis right now, if you feel there is still a lack of political will to meet the crisis from a solutions perspective at where it's at, like at a commensurate level.
Right now, the 20,000, 30,000 lives in Canada that have been lost since 2016 are being used as political fodder. Hmm. And it is not doing anybody any good out, you know. How do you weaponize someone's life? And that's what it feels like they're doing, that one side says one thing, the other side says something else. But should we be working together? This should be a nonpartisan issue. This should be a nationally declared public health emergency.
I'm going to leave it there. Tracy, I appreciate you making the time to talk with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Tracy Letts, who generously lent us her time and her voice to put a personal take on this drug overdose crisis.
We'll return with more of the big stories trending now on The Daily Review.
On News Talk 580 CFRA. Live, local, breaking news, weather and traffic. The day in news happens here. Now back to The Daily Review on News Talk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron.
Would you use a reusable bag recycling program? Come on, admit it. Everybody's got that bag of bags, that telltale thing in the back of your trunk or the back of your car or in your basement or in your home office that tells the world that you're a good citizen, you care about the environment, you opted for the green reusable bag, but then your memory failed you. Or then you meant to actually bring it into the store, but you forgot, so you bought another one. And then the next time you had two reusable bags, but guess what? Then you had to take them out of the trunk because your dog was covered in mud and you were taking your home from the dog park. And so now they're in the basement and oh, boom, now you have three reusable bags. And before you know it, they're like bunnies. They just populate on their own and you've got 15 and then you've got 20. And then you've got 40, and then who knows how many you have because you've lost count. Could you use something like this? Walmart Canada has become the first major retailer in our country to launch a national reusable bag recycling program. It is going to be through TerraCycle, and you can either send them back, you can send in your extra bags because you don't use them anymore, you don't need that many, or maybe they're damaged. And through this mail-in recycling program, they can be utilized in some way. You would need a minimum of 5 bags for shipment. They would provide you with a free shipping label. And then instead of just going to the landfill, the senior manager of sustainability at Walmart says they are going to be used some other way. So if they're being recycled, they could be processed into raw materials and then used to make things like shipping pallets and outdoor furniture. Would you use it? Lots of people writing in already. 580-580 is the number to do that. Joining us now from Environmental Defense, I have the Senior Plastics Program Manager, Karen Wersig. Great to have you aboard, Karen.
Thanks, Christy. Good to be here.
What do you think of this?
Well, listen, we have been calling for retailers to take responsibility for the bags that they're giving out with their groceries. This is sort of maybe a quarter step towards that, I would say. And I guess the issue is, you know, ideally the gold standard in a reuse program is you bring the thing back to where you bought it.
Right.
And that's not what this program does, right?
Right. Okay. And how does this differ? Why is this not as good?
Well, this seems like a one-time offer. You have to sign up online for with a third party. If you manage to get in before the available slots are cut off, like, before they fill up, you get a waybill to download and print off, and then you package up your bags in a, you know, a shippable some kind of box or envelope or whatever, and then you have to actually drop it off at the courier drop-off spot. So it's a lot of steps that people have to take to return some reusable bags.
They did say they'd send you a shipping label. Does that make it any better?
Well, sure. They email you a shipping label. I just tried it today. They email you a shipping label. You have to download it and print it off. Sure, that's great. But how many people have printers at home? And then you have to actually find a place to drop those things off that isn't the store where you bought it. So, you know, it's a lot of steps people have to take to return these bags. So it does seem like it's more of a symbolic gesture than actually a workable return system.
If we can't remember to bring the reusable bags into the store, I don't see a lot of people doing this.
That's kind of my thought. That's right. I mean, and if you have a whole drawer full of these bags or a whole cupboard full of these bags, you might think one time that you're going back to the store that you could bring them all. I mean, really the gold standard would be, could all the retailers who are using very similar bags, could they all get together, use the same bag, take them back in a local area, make sure the bags were sturdy enough that they could be washed many times, make sure they can wash them safely, get them back to customers who would use them again. That's the gold standard right there. It's a bit like, I mean, to be honest, we always point to this, but it's true. The beer bottle in Ontario that gets returned and washed out and refilled, you know, dozens of times, that's the gold standard for reuse.
Why can't we do that? For example, I think about the different colored bags that I have. The Walmart one is a bright blue color. The one for Shoppers Drug Mart is a red color, but they seem pretty much like the same bag. Why can't we do what you're describing?
Well, unfortunately, we as customers can't really do much of anything on our own. I guess that's the question to the retailers. Why can't you get together and actually come up with a bag that's usable, that's washable, that is high quality enough that it stands up to regular use, and then take those bags back, wash them out, and give them back to us, and set up a real system where we can return them conveniently. Because that means I don't have to go back to a Walmart to take my bags back. Maybe I've got them, in a basket on my bike because I'm a bike rider, or in the trunk of the car. And I remember when I get to one store or another, oh, I have all these bags here that I can drop off so that they can be washed and reused.
Do you see any motivation for the retailers to get together, to team up and collaborate, to create the system that you've just described?
Well, I don't think they're going to be motivated just on their own. This is why we've been kind of calling for a complement to this ban on single-use plastics like the flimsy checkout bags. What we're saying is there now needs to be incentives and probably requirements for reuse systems to replace single use so that we don't just get, you know, heavier duty or different material, so-called reusable bags that in fact aren't in practice reused.
I think the bag of bags is kind of like a universal experience that translates across various countries in other languages as well. It just seems like something that every human being later on in life tends to have, because everybody forgets the bag and then everybody accumulates the bags. When you step back and you look at the fact that we were trying to reduce plastic by getting rid of the old single-use plastic bags, do you think what we've done is a vast improvement on the previous system?
Well, certainly what we've done is, and I don't have actual numbers yet, but we have absolutely cut down on the number of bags that were just kind of given out like candy before. It used to be 15, in 2019, the government, federal government estimated 15 billion flimsy plastic checkout bags were given out. And we know for sure that those 15 billion weren't all reused as garbage bin liners. Like, that was so many bags. It was like each family of three got an average of 27 or 28 bags a week under that scheme. So that really meant there were bags floating away littered in parks and in parking lots. We saw bags everywhere. We know that that is not true anymore, because even now that we have to pay a small amount for these bags, you're not like putting a thing of bananas in one bag and a can of coffee in another bag, right? Like, which is what used to happen sometimes at the grocery store, where you just come home with so many bags. That problem has been largely solved, I think. The problem now is that we shouldn't be calling these bags reusable if they're not actually conveniently and effectively reused. And so instead of thinking about a product or a thing as reusable, we need to think about systems that will allow for things to be reused. And that's really where we need to get to replace all of the single-use packaging and products, both ones that are banned, and then even set up systems so that we can replace the ones that haven't been banned yet, including like coffee cups and lids that we see now littered all over the place.
Right, because to your point, even though these totes can be thicker, they can be more durable, and they certainly should be reusable, a lot of them don't get reused. And if they don't get reused, then that defeats the purpose, because they have a much higher carbon footprint than one of those old thin, flimsy plastic bags, don't they?
Well, I'm not actually sure. I'm not sure if anyone's done the analysis of these. These bags are not much different, frankly, from the film bags, except that they do stand up and, you know, they are designed to be reused at least once. Probably the carbon footprint of using those bags once is not that much more. Of the flimsy Walmart-type bags is not that much more than using the film bags. But certainly we don't want to be using, you know, cotton bags once or the heavier duty plastic sewn up bags once. And I think most people are pretty good about that. When we see a quality bag, we know that's not to be thrown out, and we do make a point of reusing it. The problem is with all these cheaper lightweight bags that you get, you know, it's sort of a trick. You think, well, these are kind of junky bags anyway. It doesn't matter how many of these I get. It's like the old-fashioned bags. And that's the kind of practice we have to get away from. And really, the only way we're going to get away from that practice is if there's a system set up that helps us do it. Because you're right, we'll otherwise, if it's not convenient, we're not going
to
do it.
What you're describing does not sound convenient to me whatsoever. Beyond that, are there any other programs that you think these things could be used for? Like somebody here, MJ from Pembroke, says, why don't we drop them off at local food banks or thrift stores? Is there something like that that you would want to suggest?
Sure, yeah. If as we're waiting for these big retailers to move, there is, you know, there is a new movement for bag libraries, and certain, like, business improvement areas might do it. Certain stores are doing it where they'll take people's reusable bags and wash them out and then offer them to customers who forget the bag so that they don't have to, you know, buy a new bag every time. So that's useful and interesting. And then, of course, if there are organizations like food banks that need bags, you know, that would be a nice thing to do. The only thing is I would recommend, a lot of charities can't handle a lot of, you know, just unwanted, unsolicited drop-offs. So always check with the organization before you just take a bunch of stuff to them.
Always great to chat with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Christy.
Karen Wirsig, who's the Senior Plastics Program Manager at Environmental Defense. We have to stop bag hoarding. Would this help you do that? As she points out, maybe it's not as convenient as we all thought. But you could use it once. Would that be successful?
Thanks for listening to The Daily Review. Remember, the day in news happens here.
Every day as events happen, we're here for you. News Talk 580 CFRA.
Live, local, breaking news, weather, and traffic.
Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.